We're all set.
If the Shah, when the price of oil went up 4 times, had taken a reasonable amount of this money and put it into better hospitals, better housing, better other things, so that the results would have trickled down to the people. If he had avoided, if he had stuck with his $31 billion program, the breakdown of the infrastructure at hideous loss, you know, stuff was piling up, ships were paying demurrage fees of 11 and 12 months because they couldn't unload. The energy structure broke down. In the hottest part of the summer, you couldn't get the desert coolers working on top of the buildings or anything else because they had energy blackouts. They couldn't deal with the problem. The rail and road infrastructure broke down. The point I make is, if the Shah had stuck with his original program and had devoted a substantial part of this to the betterment of the people, I think the situation could have evolved in a totally different way.
So you describe sort of like the makings of a sort of pre-revolutionary situation, but back, say back in 1969 and 70, the outlook was the outlook for like one of long-term stability?
The outlook at that time was that that Iran was as stable as it had been at any time in modern history, that everybody's life was getting a bit better, although the rich were getting rich, that there were plenty of problems and faults, particularly in the operation of the government, but that given the transition that was taking place from feudalism moving toward a modern industrialization of a traditionally quiescent agricultural country that had only one industrial activity, if you want to call it that, which is oil, things were moving along as well as you could have hoped them to.
Now, under Kennedy and Johnson, embassy officials had fairly routine contacts with figures in the political opposition, people from the National Front, for example. Now, was that practice continued when you were ambassador? Was that...
We saw people in the so-called National Front.
Yeah.
You know, I had them in my home.
Mm-hmm.
We saw them, but it didn't mean very much because the opposition that existed in the parliament in terms of the National Front was really sort of a staged business, which if it hadn't existed, the Shah would have had to create it, and perhaps he did help create it. They had no decisive voice or influence, and it was a very, very tame opposition, if I may call it that. We also set up, when I was there, a junior officers thing, because, you know, one of the problems with being an ambassador or being a very senior officer in an embassy is that frequently in certain parts of the world, people tell you what they think you want to hear. It's very difficult sometimes to get people in that part of the world to level with you about anything. And we had some very bright junior officers, and they used to do their own quite independent reports, which were sent into the department. They gave them to us for our comments on them, but not to tinker with the words or the prose or the organization. It was their report. And I think they were more concerned than the senior people in the embassy, including myself, about the longer-term possibilities of trouble.
What did they base their concern,
Well, I think they based their concern on the young people they talked to in the universities. You know, you can't educate people and tell them that they can't think about what's wrong with their country. If you're going to take somebody from an illiterate peasant and send him to a university and turn him out and have him take various things and study history and what's happening in other countries and so forth and so on, you're going to you're going to run into a different opinion, particularly in a society where from peasant to university student or graduate, there it is, and particularly the university students that have been sent abroad by the Shah's government to be educated in Western Europe came back, and our younger officers saw a lot of those young people, and of course they were people who supported the revolution. Let me just say in that respect that in the commando that came on me, and it was true of the 370 terrorists that were caught, revolutionaries, if you want to call them, in 1971 following the attack on myself. Without exception, almost, they were young Iranians sent abroad by the Shah's government, paid for by the Shah's government, to Western Europe to be educated so they could come back and build a modern country. And in 90% of the cases, they were recruited by the communists in French and West German universities. And when they were sufficiently militant and showed the real desire to be what our communist friends call the vanguard of the revolution, that small group were taken to West Berlin, Peterwald to East Berlin. Never, not one of them was trained in the Soviet Union. They were dispersed to various places, with the Fedayeen, some in North Korea, some in Eastern Europe, some in Libya, some in Cuba. But our young people in the embassy saw students who were graduate students back, young people of their age in their late 20s and so forth, mm-hmm. who'd been educated abroad, and their criticisms, of course, of what they saw at home in terms of a government that was autocratic, in terms of a certain amount of corruption in the life, even before 74, was, I think, something that we, at the senior level, were not exposed to because we didn't go around with those people in the sense that you weren't exposed to them at parties, at social gatherings, and at other things. You were at official functions and other things, and if you had students in or met with students, it was all in sort of a very tame way where they were very polite and didn't raise any questions.
Mm-hmm. So these officials at the low level did a pretty thorough job in looking at political intelligence.
I think what they did was they got a view of an aspect of Iranian life and a segment, and a very important segment, the young educated people of Iranian society, that the senior officers never really got, for obvious reasons, a vision of at all.
Mm-hmm. Well, these reports were passed on to Washington, the State Department.
Oh, sure. Yeah. They went back and with the embassy's comments.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Now, it's been charged, some of the accounts that I've read, some of the secondary historical works, it's been charged that Nixon and Kissinger would not accept any bad news or critical reporting about Iranian problems. Maybe this is more of a later problem after you were ambassador, but was this something, an impression that you had at that time? Or
I had no problem. I knew that they strongly endorsed the Shah's regime and felt that it was the best that we could have given the historic and actual circumstances. It was friendly, it was well disposed, it was determined to resist aggression. It was not beholden on us for economic aid. It was paying its way. Its Air Force was totally trained in America. The Shah paid something like $66,000 per trainee to the U.S. Air Force, and this made the Air Force happy. They were able by these foreign trainees to help keep bases open and do things from the point of view of their budgets that otherwise would have been more difficult.
Mm-hmm. I have questions about arms sales issues. As far as you recall, what was the initial Nixon administration stance towards arms sales to Iran? No, under Johnson and Kennedy, there was a policy of maintaining control over arms sales, you know, vetting Iranian purchases before they were made. Was this policy continued?
When I was there, the Air Force was entirely American equipped. I say entirely American equipped. The Shah paid for it, but their basic plane was the F-4, and then they had some F-5Es, F-5s, I forget which, F-5E, maybe, or whatever it was.
Yeah, yeah.
They were getting military equipment from both France and Britain. Our basic policy was that we should give them what they could absorb and assimilate and use, but we should discourage, and I certainly did my utmost with the Shah in that respect. I saw him on a number of occasions. On one occasion, I didn't know if they knew how much military equipment they were committing themselves for. They would commit themselves to a business subject to approval by the government of the sale. You know, there were arms salesmen from every American arms company and every German and British and French particularly out there. My concern, as I say, as I mentioned earlier, was that they were getting a lot of this stuff, sticking it in the barn and it would deteriorate, and that they should ease up on it, on purchases until they could assimilate it into forces that they had in being and utilize it and keep it at the ready. So I had my people in the embassy draw up a list of what we understood the Shah's commitments were. Mm-hmm. It totaled $980 some billion.
Just under a billion.
This was commitments to toward the future.
Right, long-term plans. Or
so I called up the Prime Minister and said I had something I want to talk to him privately about. So he invited me up to his home, and I said, it was Mr. Hoveda, poor Mr. Hoveda. I said, Amir, do you know how much your government is committed to for arms purchases? He said, yes. He said, I think it's about $400 to $450 million. I said, it's $980 some million. It's roughly $1 billion, because we may not have everything. But my God. He said, will you go and see the Shah and discourage him from purchasing any more equipment or perhaps reducing some of these things? And so I explained that they couldn't assimilate it. And I looked at him and I said, but Amir, you're the Prime Minister. Why should I go and tell this to the Shah? And he looked at me and he gave his pathetic smile and he shook his head and he said, you know, His Majesty, he said, Doug, His Majesty doesn't like to have negative views from any members of his cabinet. Well, I went to the Shah and told him what the extent of the commitments were. He said, well, we have the money to pay for it. All our revenues are doing well. But it gives you an idea of how the Shah ran the government, and this is one of his greatest, an equally contributing business. When he saw something that he wanted to do or he liked or he thought was a good idea, he just said, do it. And there was no business of priorities or this or that. It was just a whole series of things, one piled on top of another. And this also led to problems in every phase of the national life.
Were there requests for arms purchases that were turned down? The Shah's requests at any stage when you were ambassador?
Well, the weaponry that he I just don't remember. Yeah. We were working on I think the F-15 plane, and he felt that he had a commitment when he came over here on that first visit. I think it was the F-15. We were in the development stage.
Yeah,
at that
yeah,
time.
Yeah.
But whatever it was, he thought he had a commitment from the president that he could buy that plane, and I did not. I understood that there was no commitment on that plane, and I talked to him about it, but he never clarified it with the president.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we did not go ahead when I was there and give any approval for that advanced aircraft when it came on stream and given our own requirements.
Mm-hmm.
They were still F-4s coming in, and I think it was an F-4F by that time, and the old 5Es.
Were there any of the agencies?
F-5Es.
Any agencies back in Washington, like the Pentagon or others, sort of wanting to put control over arms sales around? Was there any sort of, were there any debates?
Yes, I remember an assistant secretary of defense came over at one time and felt that they were trying to acquire too much weaponry.
Uh-huh.
And as I said to him, you're talking to the guy that's been convinced of this a long time. But the Shah has this like a bone in his teeth, and if he doesn't get it from us, he's going to buy it from the British and the French and the Germans. And he turned to the Germans for the Leopard tank, and to the French for some form of surface-to-air thing. He took the TOW from us. The TOW was the most advanced anti-tank weapon, a ground weapon. Relatively unsophisticated and easy to use, but it wasn't a question of our being a, we didn't control the Shah.
Mm-hmm.
He made it quite clear to everybody that if he couldn't get it from us, he would turn to them.
Mm-hmm.
And of course the British and the French were dying to sell, particularly the French, to sell equipment. They wanted to sell the AMX-30, that's their tank, the AMX-15, their light tank. They wanted to sell surface-to-air missiles. They wanted to sell high-speed torpedo boats or things of that kind. The French salesmen were terrific. They were they covered the waterfront out there. They even, the TOW missile, I don't know if you know about a TOW missile, it's a wire-guided missile. The French started a report to the Iranian military that the TOW was a missile that would go astray on the battlefield because it would be attracted by battlefield fires. As if it were, you know, some sort of an unguided thing that you just threw up into the air and it went to the nearest
yeah.
heat or flame that it saw.
Yeah.
So there were all kinds of stories.
Mm-hmm. So the Shah, in actual practice, the Shah's request for arms sales purchases from the United States were more or less would take place without U.S. Control or interference. There was no effort to regulate.
Oh, sure.
I understood that properly. That's all. Yeah.
No, we tried to discourage him taking more than he could assimilate and use.
Okay.
And with certain types of advanced weapons, approval was not given.
Okay.
But
I want to make sure I know.
We made, and when the Pentagon guy came the assistant secretary, whoever he was, said, I said, you're trying to convince them. If he doesn't get it from us, I just want you to know they're going to turn to the British and the French to get it.
Okay. Now, in May 72, in connection, this was after you had left, but shortly after, in connection with the F-14 deal, Nixon agreed.
The F-14, is that what it was?
I think it was.
Yeah, I think it was.
Yeah.
I said F-15, you'll have to correct that.
That will be done. Nixon agreed to let the Shah buy any non-conventional weapon systems that he wanted. Now, was this decision in the works before you left, recall? Or was that sort of kept out of Washington?
The whole business about arms sales was, when I left, that we would have to be the final judge of whether we would release new and sophisticated weapons of various types to them.
Uh-huh.
It was in our interest that Iranian forces be brought up to the point where they could defend themselves and thus represent a deterrent. They should be able to assimilate the equipment that we gave them. But I don't recall as I say, the F-14, there was no approval of that given when I left, and that was in the category of certain sophisticated weapons that are under development, we'll have to see. And certainly the Shah asked for the F-14, I said F-15 erroneously. He asked for that when he came over in October, and that was the one where he thought he had the president's agreement, October of 69, his first visit after I became ambassador, a state visit. The F-14 was one of the things he asked for, and he did not get it, although he thought that he had it. And later, when he asked for it, he was told that it was not available for export at that time, and he said to me rather sadly, he shook his head, he was discussing this with me, and said, you were right, I thought I had a commitment, but I misunderstood.
Now, how would you characterize the Shah's foreign policy in the Middle East? What kind of a role did he want to take? Did he want to play in the Middle East?
He saw himself as the principal power in the Persian Gulf. He saw himself as the dominant power in the Persian Gulf. He wanted to reestablish friendly relations with the Arab nations on the other side of the Gulf. This was very important to him. But in doing that, he wanted also to be, there'd be no doubt about the fact that Iran was the big boy in the Gulf, which of course it was in terms of population. When you figure that Saudi Arabia at that time had a population of barely 5 million and Iran was 34 million, something like that. So he wanted a dominant position in the Gulf. The Gulf was his lifeline, as he said. If anybody interdicts the Gulf, it's like cutting an artery to my heart. And he wanted friendly regimes on the other side of the Gulf. Now, you'll ask the question, well, why, if he wanted friendly regimes on the other side of the Gulf, did he grab Abu Musa and the and Tums Islands?
I was asking about
that. He grabbed them for one very simple reason. If they were handed, Iran had had a claim to them going back a very long time, but so had the Arabs, perhaps even a longer time, what are now the Emirates. But the Shah's position was very clear. He said Abu Musa and the Tums, in the hands of unfriendly people, can interdict the mouth of the Gulf and prevent anybody going out. They can cut my lifeline. They can cut my major artery that leads to my heart.
And he explained this to you.
Yes,
sure.
Because, this to him, and then he pointed out that the channel running close to the shore was under fire of long-range artillery, and vedettes and motor torpedo boats, torpedo things could dart out and sink things in the mouth of the Gulf and close it off and everything else. And so he was quite adamant about it. What he did do, though, was to give I forget which one of the, whether it was Raz Al Khaimah or which one of the Arab Emirates, he honored part of their right to the oil around Abu Musa, I can't remember which one it was, by saying they could have a certain percentage of the oil business that came out from the exploration around the island.
Now this move was in November 71, the seizure of the island, the seizure of the islands, I think, was in 71?
Yeah, December, I think.
Oh, December?
I'm not sure, but it seems to me it was in
Did this move have tacit support from Washington? Or was there any...
The last thing in the world we wanted to do is get caught in the middle of a business where the Arabs had a claim and we had a claim. Saudi Arabia was a close friend and ally of ours. On the contrary, we had sort of hoped, I think, that there might be some way to work out some kind of a condominium arrangement with, demilitarized and
for joint control or
causing the sovereignty and uh-huh. so forth. But uh-huh. the Shah was absolutely adamant on that. The British tried very hard, very, very hard, to persuade him. And in fact, I flew up to London and saw the Foreign Minister, Lord Hume, at one stage of the game. Mm-hmm. I think I was headed home, but I stopped by there okay. just to see him and see what their things were. We, the United States and Britain, we did not, we really didn't want it uh-huh. to see him grab the islands because it raised too many problems in our relationships with other very friendly Arab countries.
I see. Now, another move was to help the Sultan of Oman's campaign against local guerrillas. Do you recall that or your reaction to that?
Well, the British played the principal role in that business.
That's
We didn't. We were virtually out of it and happy, I think, to be out of it. Mm-hmm. The British had the capabilities, they had the experience, they had been in the Gulf, they had the relationship, and so that was one that I think we felt was, in terms of the Western world, uh-huh. was not uh-huh. up to us.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And furthermore, of course, the Britain as an integral part of Europe, uh-huh. Oman in unfriendly hands would also mean, in the unfriendly hands with people like the people that had seized South Yemen and the like, would mean that the Soviet Union through surrogates might be able to close off the mouth of the Gulf. If you had an Oman that fell under the same type of regime that had the close ties and received military aid and advisors and other things from the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Whether we had anything to do clandestinely or covertly, I just don't know.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
It was outside. The Shah was all for it. He sent over, you know,
right.
1,000.
Yeah, he gave support to them.
He gave support to the Omanese.
Yeah.
This was part of the whole business. And the Shah, you know, he met King Faisal at the great Arab summit in Morocco in 67, was it? Whenever it was. At Fez, at that meeting, it was before I arrived as ambassador.
Mm-hmm.
And he told Faisal then that if ever Saudi Arabia was attacked, and he had in mind Iraq for obvious reasons, mm-hmm. because Iraq was receiving mm-hmm. support and it was threatening Kuwait and one thing or another, if ever Saudi Arabia was attacked in the area, if without any agreement he recognized the difficulties for Faisal and Arad to make an agreement with the Persian, given the disputes and one thing or another in the history, but all he had to do was to call for support, and he would send him support. And indeed, when the South Yemenis attacked a border post in Saudi Arabia, and Faisal called the Shah on his offer, the Shah, I got awakened at 1 o'clock in the morning, because the Shah wanted to use 3 aircraft to transport some heavy infantry and light infantry weapons over, and we had to give approval to the transfer of these weapons to Saudi Arabia.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And the approval came back immediately, and the weapons that the Shah that had been requested by, I think, three aircraft full of weapons went over to Saudi Arabia to help them in cleaning out the business with the South Yemenis mm-hmm. that invaded mm-hmm. their border post.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's amazing. 72 and 75, again, this is after you've left, the CIA, at the request of the Shah, gave support to Kurdish rebels in Iraq. Now, was this an issue that came up when you were ambassador, the Shah's interest in having special support for the Kurdish rebels?
Well, it didn't come up, but we knew it was happening.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
We knew that it was happening.
But he in terms of him trying to get a U.S. covert role in the situation?
No.
Was that approach made to you at all, or no?
No, we knew that it was happening, but there was never a request to me. The Shah never discussed
that issue.
The action of the Kurdish, Iraqi Kurdish rebels, because it was inside Iraq.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
All he discussed with me was all that he was trying to do to bring all he ever discussed with me were his efforts to integrate the Iranian Kurdish community into the national life of Iran, and indeed he had a Kurdish minister, one of his cabinet ministers, was a Kurd when I was there. I can't remember which one it was, but that we knew that he was giving active assistance to the rebels, and we knew that they were coming across the frontier and into Iran, and they could have a safe haven there and so forth. This was, of course, part of the basic Iran-Iraq mutual hostility.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Okay. The Shah saw it as a means of weakening Iraq, just as Israel gave aid to the Kurds.
Now, besides the October 69 meeting between the Shah and President Nixon, were there any other meetings?
69.
Yeah. Were there any other meetings where they met while you were ambassador?
I don't think so.
That was the main one. Yeah.
And the president didn't come over.
Did Kissinger ever come over? Or?
No, Kissinger just came through for a plane refuel landing after that, after he had secretly set up the Chinese thing. Remember, he went to Pakistan and disappeared on his court for two days rest, and his plane simply came through and loaded up with gas and went on home. The undersecretary came out, Elliot Richardson.
Uh-huh.
He came out on stage of the game. Now, you want to get to the oil?
Yeah. One other thing. In terms of CIA's activities in Iran, can you discuss this in general terms? What its major activities were?
The CIA had felt that they had sort of a proprietary interest in Iran because they had helped get the Shah back, and successive people had come out when I was there, Dick Helms, who was head of the CIA, came out and saw the Shah.
Mm-hmm. Were you present or not at their meeting?
I had no problem with him.
No.
I had a problem with the CIA in Japan, where they behaved in a very silly way, and I had it out with them at that time, and I really had no problems after that about him. Because when I got to Iran, I found that the CIA station chief was in the habit of seeing the Shah without any authorization from the ambassador, and then reporting without informing the ambassador what he was reporting. So I put an end to that situation when I got there. And because I had gone to President Eisenhower once before, when Alan Dulles and Dick Bissell had behaved so in such a dangerous and silly way when I was ambassador to Japan, and created some serious problems in connection with the treaty that I was negotiating. I really, after that, had no trouble at all. And I had no trouble with Helms.
Apparently, their main interest was Iran as a listening post, apparently. That's my impression, that the main interest was.
They certainly were interested in that, and they were interested in anything they could pick up.
Yeah.
You know, the way they are about anything that was going on along the borders and so forth and so on. But I had no problems with the CIA there.
Mm-hmm. 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 Okay. I think the oil issue should be brought up now. Well, the Shah, I meant the Shah did express at times his sort of philosophy of the role of oil in Iran. His philosophy of the role of oil that it would play in Iran.
Let me just think out loud with you about the oil problem.
Sure.
The Shah knew that the Persian Gulf oil was essential to Western Europe and Japan. Absolutely essential. He knew the value of that oil. He felt that the Western oil companies had really abused the oil-producing states. He felt that they had taken advantage of their position and that they had treated them in a way that was inadmissible. He pointed out to me that in 1948 or 49, the value of a barrel of oil was, I can't remember if it was $1.49, just a hypothetical figure. I'll give you hypothetical figures because I don't remember the actual one, but they're in the ratio. And then when I was there 20 years later, the value of oil was around, say, $1.69, $1.79, something like that. But in that time of those 20 years, inflation for the things that Iran had to buy with that oil, the revenues they got, had gone far beyond that.
So in
69 and 70, Iran in value, purchasing power for its oil, was getting less than it got in 49. And he looked at me and he said, "Do you think that's fair?" So he had this thing very strongly that the price of oil had to go up. Now, at the meeting in Venezuela, the Caracas meeting, the OPEC meeting in 1970, I guess it was, December.
That's right, yeah.
At that meeting, it was agreed that the following January there would be a meeting in Tehran, or was it February, January, February, that meeting, they would give the oil companies 10 days to reach an agreement for the increase in the price of oil, and that if there no agreement was reached, then the OPEC countries would go ahead and unilaterally boost the price of oil.
And they were following Libya's precedent already, weren't they? Were they trying to follow Libya's precedent in this respect?
No. Libya hadn't done anything yet.
Not yet, okay.
Not yet. I'm coming to that.
Okay. Yeah.
When all this came to me, our government made a terrible blunder at that time. In effect, they said, well, let the oil companies negotiate this.
This is the joint approach. The joint approach, as it was called then?
What?
The joint approach by the companies towards...
Sure, it was a consortium acting.
That's right.
But the government isn't behind the oil companies. Just let them go up against these guys and, you know, it's their affair and so forth and so on. That's all very well, an approach of that kind. It's since we've learned a hell of a lot better, because you learn that if you let things go that way, that if oil is going to jump up, the price is going to jump out of the sky, all of a sudden it has a hell of an effect on you. But it troubled me a great deal. So I went up and asked to see the Shah. We were in the middle of January, shortly before this meeting was going to come along. I said to him, I've been in touch with some of the OPEC people. There was a guy named Lord Scott Allman,
petroleum.
Pissy of Esso. Uh-huh. And I went up to see the Shah, and I said, Your Majesty, in this, there's one very unrealistic thing about this negotiation that's going to take place in Tehran under your leadership, and that is this 10-day, if an agreement isn't reached in 10 days, you're going to act unilaterally. I said, this consortium consists of British and American and Dutch and French. I said, it's totally impossible physically to negotiate on a basis of 10 days. I said, you meet all the day here, and then these guys, at the end of the day, they go back and they send a telegram. And they send it to London, where the representatives, the senior representatives, are going to be. But then those guys debate it all day long, and then they send the telegram back, and the time difference, that's the next day. So I said, you've got 3 days for just one exchange. And they're in any negotiation, these aren't people that are empowered to do anything, and you can't get it. There just isn't time. And then I said, if unilaterally Iran and the oil producers go ahead and boost the price of oil unilaterally without giving time for negotiation, then it will inevitably have an adverse impact on the relations between the oil-consuming nations, including the United States, and the oil-producing nations, including Iran. I said it will adversely affect relations. He looked at me. He turned deep, deep red. He slammed his fist on the table twice. And he said, Mr. Ambassador, that sounds like a great power threat. I want you to know it won't work. And he hit the table beside his chair again. I said, Your Majesty, either I did not explain myself very well, or you misunderstood the thrust of what I was saying. What I said was simply this. If you and the other oil-producing countries take steps that boost the price of oil unilaterally, tremendously, so that there is an adverse effect on the economic, industrial life, which will affect employment and everything else, in Western Europe and the United States, which are democracies, which have governments that are responsive to the public, there will be outcries about such action, and those outcries will reach the Congress, and the Congress will make its displeasure known, and the relations between our countries will be adversely affected.
Let me turn this over.